And so do you see the role of your office and of the tribunal as building up the capacity of a country like Rwanda so you can transfer these cases? Or is that something that...
Yes, I mean, you see, we did have EU funding for capacity building in Rwanda. We have European Union funding, you know, for outreach programs. We also got, you know, Rwanda requested it. And over the last 2 years, I've been running courses for the prosecution service, you know, investigation, evidence management and handling, international criminal law, procedure and practice, and trial advocacy. And it was at Rwandan request, but funded by the European Union, and we used to go there and run, you know, courses anything from 1 week to 2 weeks. So yes, we do have a role, because we acknowledged, and Rwanda acknowledged its limitations, and was preparing itself, you know, for the reception of these cases, and wasn't shy to say so, and said, yeah, you know, you guys been there, done that, you know, can you come and, you know, hone our skills, and we do have, you know, several Rwandans employed here in the Office of the Prosecutor, you know, who most probably after the closure might take their expertise back home. And one of the things we'll be looking at this conference is those countries, you know, in the sub-Saharan Africa, that may want to take on these cases because of, you know, if they have jurisdiction, if, you know, we need to identify, you know, capacity limitations. We may not be able to engage in capacity building, but I'm sure we can mobilize resources. And there are NGOs out there. There's International Criminal Law Services is an NGO that is actually focusing on capacity building. The Open Society Justice Initiative in East Africa in particular, with which I've worked closely, has an active program in capacity building. We're trying to get the teaching of international criminal law on the core curricula of universities in the region. You know, and the live issues like the Ugandan situation. I think the pretrial chamber is sitting this week, or possibly next, to consider whether the ICC should defer to Uganda to try the Joseph Kony case. Mm. They have capacity issues, and the Director of Public Prosecutions has engaged our prosecutor here. So yes, there's a role we could play in terms of capacity building for those who, you know, acknowledge the need and ask for it.
What do you think still needs to happen in order for a case to be successfully referred back to Rwanda?
We lost in two things. And one can be corrected legislatively or judicially. Is the question of there's some ambiguity on the sentencing regime in Rwanda. It wasn't clear, conflicting pieces of legislation, you know, and the doubt was resolved in favor of the accused. There was a potential threat that if sentenced in Rwanda, he may be held in solitary confinement. We didn't buy that, but that was what the judges, both the trial chamber and the appeal chamber, thought. The more complex matter that seems incapable of resolution is this whole issue of witness availability. I don't know whether you've read the appeals chamber decision in Nyakazi, but basically it comes down to the appeals chamber saying the determinant for a fair trial is that the whims of an unidentified witness, saying, hey, I'm afraid of going to Rwanda. That's what it comes down to.
And is there anything that can be done about that, or that's?
Well, no, not. I mean, neither the chamber, the trial chamber nor appeals chamber really conducted sufficient inquiry. Rwanda has facilitated witnesses, defense witnesses, to come to the tribunal and safely return to Rwanda. I'm yet to hear of a defense witness who's been bumped off. It's our prosecution witnesses who get bumped off. But Rwanda, too, has facilitated the travel of witnesses to Belgium, to Canada. For the trials, Belgium has held to date, I think, about four trials, the Butare 4, the Kibungo 2, Ntuyahaga. About seven, eight accused defendants. And Rwanda has facilitated the travel of both prosecution and defense witnesses who've safely returned home. We don't have any capacity for protecting witnesses in Rwanda. It's done by, the Rwandans. We protect witnesses when they're in Arusha by driving them around in bulletproof cars. But when they go back to Rwanda, the actual protection is the duty of the state. And when threats are reported, we don't have the capacity to do the policing. We refer the matter to the Rwandan authorities, who take care of the security of witnesses. I was just looking, for example, at the Canadian statistics, where the defense had seven witnesses fly in from Rwanda and took depositions of another 17, So the judge, the single judge in the Munyaneza case in Quebec, didn't get to meet the 17. They didn't have any video link testimony, no. It was, I don't know whether you're familiar with depositions taken on a commission rogatoire. Basically, prosecution and defense, with an office of court, go to a country, in this case Rwanda, and take, record the testimony. So the testimony of 17 witnesses was paper testimony. I mean, the judge didn't meet them. The same thing applies to the current trial against Joseph Mpambara in the Netherlands. The investigating judge went to Rwanda, heard all the evidence by deposition. It's like a mini trial. You've got the prosecution, defense represented, and the investigating judge, asks all the questions, and if either party wants to intervene, they're free to do so. And he's carried all this paperwork back home. No witnesses traveling to The Hague, for the classical, adversarial hearing as we know it here. Now, So, you know, the point I'm trying to drive home is that the judge or judges determining the matter don't actually have to have physical contact with the witness. Same thing happens in France. They're most probably, if, you know, the two cases they're prosecuting, they'll probably send, you know, an investigating judge down to Rwanda, who, you know, bring back the papers. And so if it's good for other countries, for other legal systems, why not for Rwanda, which is a hybrid between adversarial and inquisitorial? Assuming for a moment that not all defense witnesses would be willing to come to Rwanda, they can have an investigating judge go, you know, with the defense and prosecution to take depositions. We have it here. I mean, it's the exception to the rule. We have video link, and so do they in Rwanda. They've made provision for video link testimony, which is becoming very common now. And they've got provisions for taking deposition evidence. So yes, I think. The decision was very harsh on Rwanda, and it's ridiculous to the extent that the determinant of a fair trial is left to the whims of, in this case, unidentified witnesses. There was no witness list, you know. There was no evidence that the witnesses, purported defense witnesses, would be reluctant to go. Nobody had interviewed them to find out, you know. I mean, at least no evidence was presented to the trial chamber. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do you correct that? There's, you know, we can't, there's no provision for appeal against, you know, an appeals chamber decision is final. So how do you correct that? It's basically ruled out any transfers to Rwanda. So even if, and this is what is happening right now, I think they're trying to get a judicial or legislative interpretation of the applicable law with regard to sentencing. Even if that is sorted out and clarified, still, you know, you can't have a fair trial because some witnesses would be reluctant to go. And yet, you know, there's no evidence, you know, from the witnesses. You know, we'd applied in the alternative that, you know, this matter be remitted to the trial chamber for further inquiry.
Not done.
Not done. Mm.